Good day and welcome. March 31st, 2022. The world at war. These are amazing times to be alive. I say this for a reason. The question really before us, following up from our discussion yesterday, is whose Great Reset? There are multiple different possible resets, and among them are ones that work for us. There are some people who want things to go back to how they were. But by and large, their position in life is not anywhere near the vast majority of people in the US or in Europe. And this is where the reset is taking place. The reset is not taking place in most of the rest of the world. And you have to think about that. The scope of the power of the Atlanticists is specifically confined to the so-called international community, which we have shown in maps, are really fewer countries out of the nearly 200 countries in the world we're talking about. Less than three dozen. The sad thing is that for many people, these were among the more desirable places to live. But for those of you born in the last 30 or 40 years, within that time, so maybe you're 15 or 25, 40, 45, that hasn't really been the case. And the simulacrum of the standard of living enjoyed in the so-called first world is precisely that. A simulacrum. People with reasonable levels of self-motivation live in bigger homes with more free time and enjoy a more sustainable pace of life than many of you do. The so-called developing world has caught up in ways that you could describe as combined and uneven development, meaning that yes, in the very rural parts of those countries, you have a lot of shanty towns, but for people with generally basic skill sets, generally basically computer literate, basically clean, life is a lot better than it is for many Americans today. But people living in the Western world are in the greatest fight for the future of pluralist and republican forms of governance. Probably not seen since the fall of fascism 75 years ago. As then, society had to be built up from a war. Today's war has been more like an economic war of the plutocracy, the oligarchy, against the republic, more like a class war. waged by the super wealthy against people nominally of their own country. We used to talk about the biggest crime of Saddam Hussein wasn't his war with Iran, but that he attacked his own people. How is that different in any way, except that it's done in a less overt way, but certainly with greater impact, affecting many more people? How is that any different from what you see from Klaus Schwab and his little autistic, genocidal, asshole dwarf, Yuval Noah Harari? People ask me, how do people like this end up like that? Just look at him. He exudes rat consciousness. He exists for himself. This is clear. It exudes from his essence. Klaus Schwab is exactly how he sounds and as he appears to you. Marina Abramovich is exactly how she sounds and how she appears to you. There is nothing being veiled. Everything has come out in the open. In that sense, it's biblical. All lies will be revealed as lies. All truths will be revealed as truths. But the more amazing thing is that all of these projects, from Harari to Bill Gates, all of them are masters of marketing. They're masters of PR. They have whole teams behind them to produce this. And so we are left with really only two viable perspectives that explains this, which is, one, they are trying to scare you. They are trying to horrify you. And I think this is reasonable to conclude, to deduce. And the other is perhaps an emperor has no clothes situation. You can imagine Bill Gates, for his own egoistic reasons, wants to be the front man of the band. And it's like, no, you're the songwriter. We'll you're the band's producer, but he wants to be the front man. And he surrounds himself with people who reaffirm that, and that's a good idea. Oh yeah, Mr. Gates, let's right away, sir. So that's another possibility we really have to contend with. But in the first case, you can see an angle there, because the solutions that rout these people out of power are precisely the fourth industrial revolution, 3D printing, and the internet for things. But they've redefined these to be completely based on depopulation, planned obsolescence, and various elements of biological warfare, weapons of mass destruction used upon civilian populations to affect some degree of population reduction. If you look at one of the outcomes of all wars, especially in the 20th century, it hasn't been missed that, it hasn't been left out of the equation, it has not been forgotten, to be clear, that the 70, 80 million people killed in World War II, if you look at the average population growth rate, et cetera, has reduced human population significantly more than the number of people who died, because that was 80 years ago. And you figure a generation every 20, 25 years. So think about it in these terms. And why they had to change the status quo. Consider it as any other war. And this is why I shared the cover and some screenshots of that text the other day, focusing on a few passages about the undesirability of elective warfare. This was from the Robert Jervis text, which is probably mandatory reading for most postgraduate studies in international relations or international political economy. It's called How Statesmen Think, The Psychology of International Politics. If the status quo is working well enough, or if the problems with it are tolerable enough, even into the foreseeable future, you don't normally initiate a war. You initiate a war when you have reached a crisis that you can project in the near-term future, because any number of other potential fixes that you had in mind, you've implemented those first. One was to destroy the Middle East, to make the entire region a wasteland, to neutralize Iran and to allow Israel to perhaps not territorially grow as a nation state with borders, but for their investment schemes and their control over Syrian and Iraqi resources and water in particular. That did not happen. Whatever they got, they did get some things from the second Gulf War, but Iran also picked up a lot from that too. So there's an interesting ecosphere in that region that raises other questions I won't get into. However, the other part of the plan was to extend this Balkanization type thing they do with these color revolutions and Arab Springs that create failed states and fractured half-fledgling little statelets. They plan to extend that through the Russian Federation and to create 10 to 14 additional countries. So a lot of Latvias and Estonias throughout all of the Russian Federation. And this would have created, it would have extended the lifespan of a series of future speculative bubbles. The European Union, in terms of its physical component of what is realistic about it, is very much based in the promise that in the future, that by getting in these Warsaw Pact countries, whether it be, you know, Bulgaria, Poland, etc., that they would reap the benefits from that in the future. And really the benefit that was reaped was in the promise that would happen in the future. So it was actually like a Ponzi scheme about the future of Europe. And that future of Europe is actually our past now, speaking from the year 2022 in the future. We are in the future. This is an important way to understand this. If in the future is the time the entire paradigm shifts and the order of things collapses, as you understood in your childhood through fiction, through the warnings of prophets, or in popular culture even. This order began to collapse at a very fast pace, probably with the destruction of Libya, because Libya was fully invested with French and Italian capital firms, and there was no reason for an elective warfare to destroy the confidence to destroy Libya, excuse me, the confidence in markets was seriously undermined. The idea that countries would want to play ball and would really not be constantly hedging against the main proposed path, and that those hedges wouldn't be in excess of those actually buying into the path. Why would all these countries agree to commit ritual suicide? There's no reason. People in the world are not that dumb. This is how we think about things. So for we in the West, we're being confronted with this great reset, which alludes to post-war reconstruction. That's what the entire Build Back Better is all about. Now, Build Back Better has been failing. They're putting up people who, public relations experts behind the Klaus Schwabs and the Hararis and the Bidens, and know that these people are repulsive to anyone paying attention. I mean, you might get high school students to write essays about why this is a good thing, and that's about where it ends. Or university students with the mental maturity of high school students to write about why these are good things. That's it. They'll grow out of it too. Because they were so out of touch with how people really live their lives. For a whole generation of people, we've already been living under an ever-increasing austerity regime. This is a regime that can only be explained as some toxic combination of the systemic inevitabilities of a consumer-driven society on the foundation of planned obsolescence and the never-ending greed and lust for power which defines whole sections of the sociopathic oligarchy. It was 2 years ago in October that we saw UK's Prime Minister Boris Johnson stand in front of a Build Back Better sign, speaking to the need for a great reset, which was also Joe Biden's campaign slogan. And while this raises many other questions for another time, Biden has gotten rid of the Build Back Better slogan. Now, being skeptical is important. Being cynical is a mental disorder. And cynics will say that they've rebranded it to make it more palatable. And I would say to them, well, no shit, Sherlock. It's because we're winning. That's why it's unpalatable. They know their market research. They conduct their groups. They bring people into a room and they, by demographic, and they have them review things. And what's your reaction to this? So they show people pictures of faces. Klaus Schwab, he looks scary. Okay, good, good. We want to put Klaus Schwab out there. That's what people say when they see him. But he sounds very scary. So they are going full crisis mode. You see, this type of fascism, it's a type of fascism in a sense. I use that word cautiously. It's not really fascism. Fascism was based in the level of technique and technology and the state of the global developmental forces at that time, a century ago, and the world has only changed. But what it shares with fascism is its misanthropic approach, its anti-human element, which many people also don't know, use themes of social justice and even contained within it themes of critiquing the injustices of society in Germany. That was the injustices and corruption of Weimar Germany. And so there are contained these leftist and social democratic critiques, which are appealing to most thinking people who are not aware of how these are used towards typically demagogic means. But as you can hear from myself, I am also attacking the oligarchy and the injustices in society. So we can see that the way that evil works is by hijacking and derailing elements of the truth. Elements of the truth. Evil has no power in and of itself. It is not a source. It doesn't have a source of power other than the primary mover, which is both truth and good and beauty. So evil is a corruption of all of these things. It takes that and twists it by manipulating human free will, which has power in the world. Evil by itself has only temptations, mirrors, mirages, and flattery. And Build Back Better is falling apart. But we saw them with this sort of Operation Lockstep. And as we have explained in our series, lockstep has never been achieved. It's the dream of tyrants and technocrats. It never works out as planned. The status quo for a plutocratic system that is succeeding is to create illusions of citizen participation by reinforcing that illusion with many, many layers of reality, so that for those of you living in the simulacrum, you experience freedom and democracy. And only when a crisis comes do they resort to misanthropy, which is against humans. That's the meaning. It's anti-human. And this word transhumanism, which in some way seems to borrow from Nietzschean themes, requiring a transvaluation of all hitherto existing values, of course, itself has liberatory potential, like all things with elements of truth, but twisted in the direction against human will. The foundation of love is freedom. Without freedom, there can be no love. We were endowed by our Creator with one primary inalienable right, which is the right to choose our destinies. Just like God gives you the choice of love. Now, with love comes commitments, and those commitments lead in very important directions in our practical lives. So anyone who's trying to eliminate your freedom is always acting on the side of evil. They may offer security. They may offer flattery. They may offer you a sense of esteem or public accolade. But fundamentally, these are never yours because they were given to you by someone who can take them away as soon as you exercise love. So the more pertinent question to ask is, in whose interest is this great reset being carried out? Certainly, it cannot be left to those who have built their careers upon the theory and practice of austerity. Certainly, it cannot be left to those who have built their careers as puppets of a morally decaying oligarchy. But Biden and Johnson and Klaus Schwab and Harari call the Great Reset. Biden defines this as his version of the Green New Deal, which was the Biden plan for a clean energy revolution and what was it? Environmental justice. Now, certainly the coming economy cannot be left to Klaus Schwab, the IMF, the technocrats, or their puppets like Johnson and Biden. How is it that Johnson spoke publicly of a great reset, whereas just before that, when those outside of the ruling media paradigm would use that phrase, when those people engaged in a new resistance against this technocracy, when they used that phrase to describe exactly what the plan was, they were censored by the corporate media as being conspiracy theorists? This is a very important question to examine. And it's been said, and I'm not original in saying this, but certainly it's worth saying again that the difference between conspiracy theory and the truth appears to be about 6 months. And so we have all by now read numerous articles in the official press talking about how economic life after the mystery illness will never be the same as it was before. And they would not have moved themselves out of a status quo. The oligarchy would not have moved themselves out of the status quo if their own position was not seriously threatened. We're talking about an existential crisis. And they had to project the simulacrum of lockstep and uniformity. And they played upon very known dimensions in social psychology, which is that people tend to regurgitate the talking points of the status quo when in polite company or at the water cooler, as they used to say, standing in line at the post office, at the bank, at the grocery store. Maybe with other parents waiting to pick up your kids. This is the polite banter, and we're cautious to step out of the controlled paradigm of social acceptability. But they've also found that when you get many people alone to talk about what they really think, if they think, they universally express apprehensions with the agenda being put forward for this reset. Now, bear in mind that I've explained before and connected the dots between polling and opinion data aggregators and analysts like Cambridge Analytica based upon the data used, pulled from Facebook. And so they know exactly what people think because all of your private messages and posts and different groups that you were just, even if you didn't participate in those groups, of course they ranked if you did, but everyone was being profiled. And not just for persecution reasons, but actually to understand what people really think. And they know how it works. At a given time, it doesn't really matter what percent is for or against something. So long as you have between 3 and 5% of a population is highly motivated and highly activated to evangelize truth about a great evil, we're talking social and political evils, that it's not before long, that 10% of the population, which is that every person convinces someone else, one other person, that's not a great, difficult task. And that 10% then, in short time, expands to be a very important plurality of highly motivated people. Many people are simply NPCs, and they will neither support a new resistance, nor will they oppose a new resistance. And this is what the elites are terrified of. That's why they try to create a political mass. They try to form a very low-level discourse, meaning low-level meaning low-level of commitment, low-level of knowledge, on an emotional foundation for people observing that status quo politeness. It's particularly a feature in Anglo-Saxon culture, German, English, American, A5 countries. It's particularly an Anglo-Saxon cultural feature. The French and the Greeks and the Italians will. You can even watch them beating each other up in Parliament. There are parts of the world where you can talk about politics and religion, and you can even throw shit at each other and make up and be friends. But in highly atheistic societies, your political opinions about a certain thing take the place of your actual ethical and moral practices as an individual human being in the world. The revelation to me, and what changed my life tremendously, was when I realized the epiphany that a person's political views have nothing to do with their justness, fairness, compassion, firmness, resoluteness, honesty, integrity in the world, as they actually operate in the world as a person. People, especially men, arrive at ideological commitments, oftentimes very, especially in first world countries, very alienated and very disconnected from their practical life. Which is also why many decent people support very lethal political agendas. Consider this for a moment. Let's meditate on that for a moment. So they have banned any substantive discussion about what exists in lieu of globalization. When I first began writing about multipolarity a decade ago, there were attempts by Atlantic Council lackeys working through grants from Columbia University, et cetera, through these Soros NGOs that tried to say that the word multipolarity was a dog whistle for the far right and white supremacy. In other words, the idea that Africa, that Latin America, that Europeans as the indigenous people of Europe, that Asia, India, that these regions of the world, these continents, that they should have sovereignty, freedom. The self-determination of peoples, which is enshrined in the UN Charter, which has many, many good things in it, despite the organization so often being subverted by oligarchies against its better parts. And they lost that fight. They lost that fight. It's ridiculous now. And then they killed what the word far right and neo-Nazi and white supremacist means, to the point that when you have actual Nazis in Ukraine, people think that you're referring to the everyone I don't like as a Nazi. And it's hard to say, no, these are literal Nazis. Well, what's a literal Nazi? I thought using the word literal meant an analogy. No, that's literary. It's a literary expression. Literal means they actually are. Literally means literal. So the discourse was sanctioned itself. And we have consistently spoken of multipolarity. And this term in decades past was utilized frequently in Western vectors in the sphere of geopolitics and international relations. And then they tried to ban the term as if it meant something wrong. And until the moment of change, we were bereft of a language with which to have an honest discussion about the post-globalization paradigm. They did this to themselves. And one of their main tactics is to deprive us of a language to express an alternate vision by co-opting all of the themes of what an alternate vision would look like and make them their own, so that when people like Bill Gates and Klaus Schwab and Harari are saying them, we go, we're just united in opposition to that. But without articulating a positive vision for the future, which recognizes that some of these technologies are the product of the general organic tendency of technologies to increase over time, then how do we account for those? How do we use these towards liberatory projects? Until now, we had only been given a steady diet of distancing, lockdowns, provisions, quarantining, track and trace, what else? Well, anyway, we've had forgotten entirely about the fact that that was supposed to just be a 2 or 3 week long exercise to flatten the curve. And now then the truth emerged that what was being planned is a new proposal being disguised as a whole new proposal for society to be structured, being disguised as a temporary measure to handle a global pandemic. And so one of the large problems that arose in discussing the Great Reset is that a false dichotomy rose around it. Either one wants things to be how they were before and without changes to the status quo, which is very appealing to millionaires. Maybe people who are retired and own their home and have an investment and a pension. Or they promote this Great Reset, you see. It's a false dichotomy. What we propose is that any new resistance must oppose their new normal, Great Reset, while also understanding the inherent problems of what had been normalized up until COVID. You see, the way things were before was also a tremendous problem. And yet now it only seems better in comparison to the police state-like provisions we've encountered throughout the course of politicizing the specter of this mystery illness. Oddly, this politicization is based in precisely understanding how to divide people and to create a mass of go along to get along. The idea that you can take the concept of go along to get along and combine that with call out culture and cancel culture and weaponize this into an attempt, a gambit at a new totalitarian system based on a new technocracy would have been absurd if you had written about it in fiction. I'm a fan of Kuhn in his work, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. Science is always evolving and by definition potentially overturns consensus paradigms. This is the bait that we have not only seen, and this fact by itself is a problem. We have not seen a public debate on potential outcomes of what a Great Reset should look like. It is being delivered now in a phase of terrorist threats. Klaus Schwab has done nothing but issue terrorist threat after terrorist threat. Pandemics, floods, cyber attacks, food shortages. And these threats are levied and they have a solution. And yet, none of these things were problems before. The problems appeared with the people speaking of the problems. In truth, decisions that a society decides to take should be driven by reason, prudence, justice. Now, what is or isn't scientific, of course, plays a role, but it cannot be the deciding factor. For example, this is a analogy that I'm prone to make often, is that science clearly says that we may eliminate crosswalk injuries by banning street crossing or by banning driving. But what policymakers have to do is, and I've said this before, I think in my last stream or the one before, is that policymakers have to account for the need to have both cars and crossing the street. And deciding how, if it's even possible, to reduce injuries can never have a zero threat criteria as the foundation for freedoms being turned on and off like a light switch. Science is only part of that equation. The other problem is the newspeak, the Orwellian newspeak around reset. Indeed, it is itself misleading, and we would propose intentionally so if we understand Orwell's critique of the use of language, newspeak, in technocratic oligarchies. Now, people like to say that Orwell wasn't writing a guide on how to do these things, people. Well, actually, he was. He was a British intelligence agent officer who was involved in working for the fascist side in the Spanish Civil War. By putting himself in one of the factions of the Republican side of the left to split and divide them. And companies that he was connected to were opening fire on other Republican forces. So he was really like a fifth column, so to speak. And he was involved in the torture of prisoners. So just like in 1984, you have the torturer. In a way, he's both characters. In a way, he's a little bit like Junger's idea of surviving a technocracy as a sovereign person, living and working within a bureaucracy. So in that sense, he's like the main character in 1984, but he's also the torturer. A reset textually refers to going back to something once known, erasing defects or contradictions which arose along the way, which carries with it the familiar, and something we had previously all agreed to. A reset, by definition, means going back to how things were before, not just recently, but at some point farther back. But that definition is literally contrary to how the word Great Reset is used. So that term reset also echoes with something that many people want, which is a jubilee, a reset of our own debts. And they're willing to do that now that there's no way to collect these debts because their entire Ponzi scheme has collapsed, is in free fall as we speak. This is like the one last shebang bubble to re-Ponzi the Ponzi a little bit. Just kick the can down. It's falling apart. So think about it in those terms. They use extraordinary planning and thoughtfulness. But rather than you being forgiven, what they actually want to do is not forgive the debts. Call it like it's a forgiveness, maybe, or make you think that that's one possible outcome, but it's actually a repossession, but then allowing you to be the tenant of your repossessed property. Therefore, you will own nothing and be happy because you'll have everything you had without that burden of ownership, which we have taken to mean as mortgages, which we understand as debt. See how for how long they have twisted and fucked up these words in our mind to come to these conclusions. We have to untangle them to understand them. The concept of reset simultaneously straddles two unique concepts, you see. It bundles them together at once into a single term in a manner that reduces nuance and complexity and therefore also reduces thinking. It does so while appealing to the implicit notion of the term that it relates to a past consensus agreement. In fact, what they're doing is introducing a new agreement without a referendum. If understood as we're told to understand it, we are supposed to hold onto these two mutually contradictory notions at the same time, collapsed into one word. We are incongruously told that this reset must effectively restore society to how it was at some point before, because things can never be how they were at any time before. Think about that. Only within the paradigm of this vicious newspeak could anything have ever been introduced into public thinking. This textual construction does not make a bit of sense. Now I will look at questions. Thank you. Let's look at questions. Now, let's see. Skywatcher asks, if Ukraine has 600,000 troops and Russia 200,000, so I have read, why is Ukraine asking for volunteers and mercenaries? That is a very good question. They really messed up with the mercenaries. Having these mercenary bases hit was a huge PR blow. It was a huge public relations catastrophe that these several of these bases now with mercenaries have been hit. The purpose of the volunteers slash mercenaries is so that these people are engaged in social media. They're supposed to run YouTube accounts and TikToks and Twitters, and they're supposed to be like these. You're supposed to think all of them that they're like these special forces, heroes of fortune, or soldiers of fortune, heroes, wartime heroes. And they're supposed to connect to audiences and from the countries that they come from. So you have like Swedes and English, Australians, Americans. That's supposed to connect the audience and tie them into a narrative because it's intimate. It's like a person, it's a single individual, and you're supposed to experience it along with them and think the thoughts that they have as they think the thoughts and see the world through their eyes and identify with them. Self to other identification. And that is why, the main reason why. If you look at the propaganda, they're certainly not trying to attract serious mercenaries. I mean, I think this is not the kind of conflict that serious mercenaries get involved in. I mean, they would do like bodyguard work or security stuff. But no one is trying to be, just think about this, people. Just let's use our heads. No soldier of fortune in his right mind is going to get paid any sum of money to fight on a force in a land war in Eurasia against Russia. A land war in Eurasia against Russia. You'd have to only attract people incredibly naive, the Redditors. People who've been poisoned by their own societies, Orientalism, these tropes and memes about the ineffectiveness of the Russian force. That is really what it is. That's my take on it. I'm sure I have other ideas. If someone had other ideas, I didn't mention them, I'd probably agree to anything thoughtful as a reason. But that's what I would say. Paul Carrier asks, is Europe going to ration food and fuel? Well, in some way, they already do. Because creating mechanisms that create prices through policy, through sanctions, is policy, it's regulation. Sanctions and embargoes are a type of regulation, it's not actually open trade. And that will create a price point which reduces access to people. So you might think of a ration as being everyone's a citizen, like one man, one vote, and everyone gets an equal ration. No, the way rationing works in class societies is that people with millions of dollars will just pay more, and people without millions of dollars will eat less and consume less fuel. So there's already rationing happening. Every time in the US you see $7 a gallon gas, that's a form of rationing when you really think about it. Faye P asks, can you speak about the situation in Mariupol? They go on, he goes on, or she goes on. From various Greek commentators, I hear that they believe that the situation is deal done. Yeah, it was done a number of days ago. I think Mariupol fell 5 or 6 days ago. And everything up is just mop up. I mean, this is not a village. This is a pre-war population city of about 500,000 people. It's fairly large. There's many streets and buildings. Now, Russian armies had it surrounded for a long time. So it's been very hard to get in and out. And this was done, they were surrounded and they were done a long time. You could just starve them out, okay? Problem is you had the civilians, they were being cannibalized. I'm not talking about eating their, I'm just saying like they were, their own food stores were being pillaged by Azov. Their own gasoline from their cars was being, you know, commandeered, requisitioned, whatever. It was a humanitarian crisis caused by Azov not surrendering. You know, they would all be alive and there would have been no damage to the city if the militarily inevitable outcome had been realized that what happened because these Azov were ideologically motivated and they have the slogan like never surrender, things like that, which is, you know, nice slogan to have in life. But when it comes to your not surrendering causes tens of thousands of people to die, potentially, I don't know that we'll ever know the real scope of things that happened in Mariupol, because Russia will win this conflict and the victors write the history. And on the other hand, groups like, you have like Kenneth Roth and Human Rights Watch, they lie a lot. So we'll never really know what happened. And I'm not even saying the truth is somewhere in the middle. But it's normal to surrender when the situation is done. But I think that they were being told to hold on because something's going to happen with Poland, or the U.S. is going to get involved, or there's going to be a no-fly zone, or we're going to threaten to put a no-fly zone, and the to not have a no-fly zone, Russia will agree to lift the siege on Mariupol, something like that. So they were told reasons to hold on as well. But you're going to have groups of 5 and 10 people, 2 and 3 people still in these buildings. And you can't declare the operation completely over until every single last one of them, give or take maybe a few dozen, is accounted for. You don't want them getting out and escaping justice, and you don't want them to be able to engage in a low-intensity terrorist guerrilla campaign war of attrition. You know, even after World War II was over, these same people, these Banderists, waged a guerrilla struggle, a guerrilla campaign, until like the middle 1950s. Like they were not put out of commission until almost like 10 years after the end of World War II. So precedence informs us that they have to be dealt with completely. I'm looking at other questions. Peter Hart asks, what do you expect to happen in the next month in Ukraine as well as here in the US? That is a very big question. I will just say briefly that it's better to hear me, better to understand what are the mechanisms in place, what has happened so far and why. And then you can see the different possible outcomes that can occur. I said the other day that, you know, the United States could do an about face. There's many weird things going on with the executive branch, and there's big questions about. It's clearly not Joe Biden because he has dementia. So no one disputes that Joe Biden is not the president of the United States in function. So there's no doubt about that. nobody believes that he's the president in function. So the question is, what's going on behind the scenes? What type of peace agreement or co-power agreement or arrangement? It's not just Obama. Obama set up many elements of the way to use a senile Joe Biden. But too many things about the foreign policy are suggestive of it's not Obama either. Or the people behind Obama. There's many things about this presidency and its foreign policy which are far too similar to the policies of Trump. And many of you will take that to mean different things, and you might hate Trump and then agree what that means for different reasons, and that's all fine and good, but we can all agree that many things in Biden's foreign policy are actually Trump. And as I have explained for years, the whole MAGA thing as a platform mostly rests upon disentangling from NATO and the type of agreement or deal that could be made with Russia to give it what it wants. And there's, you know, many different psychological tropes can be used that are common conservative tropes, like that have grown up through American culture, that can be used in different ways to affect many good outcomes, both for China and the US. So blaming China for things is fine in many ways. So it's very complex, provided that, you know, if China had less ability to sell their products externally, then they would double down on focusing on their domestic market, which would continue to lift millions of people out of poverty and build China's middle class, which I'm not an expert on the internal mechanisms of Chinese society, but typically speaking, a larger middle class tends to increase the plurality and freedoms in a society, in a modern society of the 20th century type. China straddles in different places because, as we've said, they accomplished three industrial revolutions within the span of 70 years, whereas the United States began the first industrial revolution around 1790. Many different things going on. So the U.S. could definitely pivot, turn around, and turn the fuel back on. We could have simultaneously, we could create a two currency system and have a weak dollar, but people, so long as you were buying domestic goods, you wouldn't experience it as a weak dollar. It would just be a weak dollar on exchange, on foreign exchange, and imports would be more out of reach. Things made in China and Europe would be more expensive. That makes sense. So it would compel import substitution industrialization, which is exactly what Russia did during its weak ruble catastrophe that began around 2014 and worked well for them. And through it was hard, but many things, it became rational at the value of the ruble to industrialize internally things that had been made to be reliant, dependent on imports. So that's called ISI. So there's many possible outcomes for the US. The biggest threat, really, the economic danger, in terms of the foundations of the economy, is really Europe. The US has energy and food. The U.S. has energy and food. And Europe doesn't have enough of that to support a population of 400 or 500 million, if you add all the European countries together, including the EU states and the Balkans. You would have to bring back to life a lot of the agriculture in Bulgaria and Romania, things like that. Or you would need to have good, really, it's really to have a good relationship with Russia and to have a Ukraine that's not a failed state, exports of wheat. So, yeah, that's how I would answer that. I don't know if that's sufficient for you, but. James Coe asks, how do you interpret the event of the Freedom Convoy in Canada that came and went? Yeah, the domestic situation, you know, these are very hard to pull off. And the problem that any new resistance faces is an understanding the relationship between the withdrawal of work versus a blockade and how to build popular support and how to coordinate those types of boycotts, blockades, and strikes across both upstream and downstream sectors of the same of the interdependent sectors of that economy, which is really the whole thing. So that you don't actually have one group of the population mad at the other group because they're blockading or they're on strike. Because a strike over there that's proactive ends up being a loss of work or even a lockout for people in other sectors of the economy. And the new populism has come out of the conservative middle class and working class. And there's been a difficulty in understanding the labor organizing tactics of the old left from 100 years ago. I would recommend the Sylvester Stallone movie Fist or the Jack Nicholson movie Hoffa. Maybe there's all sorts of films that kind of through drama and creative license, tell stories about what built the middle class for workers, not for entrepreneurs. You can't have all merchants in a society. You have to have people who work, who turn the gears, who swing the hammer, who lay the shovel into the ground. All of these people are Americans. And individual approaches don't necessarily work. Because at any given time, you need X amount of people doing those things. So you can't just have a policy that says, well, if you don't like it, do something else, because someone has to do it. And so what are the conditions of those people? And those are the tactics and organizing that have been lost. It's right there for you to learn. It's right there to be learned about and to be applied. So I think that these trucker convoys fail. Number one, they were virtual and relied upon the internet, which is good, but they need to be actually rooted physically in the grassroots, in the physical locations that they mobilize so that people physically there in the creation of tent cities don't see that as a blockage but as a community effort. There's much more we can go with this, but you get the idea. It's really the failure of the new populism to learn from the history of successful populisms in the past, because these words like left and right keep changing meanings. So many people in the new populism today are looking at conservative thinking from 100 years ago to find answers to conservative populism today. And largely they won't find them there because these words dance about. And the oligarchy and the elites control language to create discursive frameworks to kind of create distinct secreted packets of knowledge which actually apply to a certain demographic but they create the language game so that you're turned off from that packet of knowledge. Because people tend to equate that words have consistent meanings in time, because we should expect that words have consistent meanings in time, because otherwise things are irrational. But confusion and irrationality have actually been weaponized tactics of the ruling class. Those are my thoughts about the trucker convoys that came and went. They didn't learn the lessons of how to do them. The people doing them might have had some knowledge, maybe read something, and I'm not putting that past anyone, but they failed to connect with communities at large. And it was particularly unsustainable because of the cost of fuel and how do you move these trucks around. It must have been $5,000 per, it's a cost. It's not just the cost that you're not working. That's why unions have strike funds. That's why you pay dues into a union for a long time, maybe 10 or 15 years, and you build a strike fund, a treasure chest, a war chest, and then you can afford to go to war. Without that, you're effed. TMT asks, why is Putin still allowing exports to America like fertilizer, uranium, after they're currently trying to overthrow Putin? Because Putin doesn't represent himself. He represents a country. And the United States is not an individual guy. It's not Biden. Okay, the U.S. is not Biden or the cabal. That's American people. What the cabal wants to do is create crisis and instability and havoc and mayhem to push civilian populations either into defeat, submission, or drastic and radical solutions that are going to be paradigm controlled by the same elites themselves. If you had an army of 15 million angry unemployed men, or 30 million, or 50 million. And then you were able to make that be that the reason for all of this is something with Russia. So if you just pick up arms and defeat Russia, then we can have all these things again. It's important. Statecraft, trade, and diplomacy isn't just about using sticks. You use carrots, and use as many carrots as possible. You use carrots, and you use sticks, but you don't forget the carrots. It would be disastrous in the United States for my family, my loved ones, because of a fertilizer crisis or nuclear power plants can't run, for them to have to pay $300 for a loaf of bread and have energy on for 2 hours a day. I don't want that for my family. And many people experiencing that would become radicalized, and many of them would be wise about what's happening and why, and that would create further instability inside the United States. And that type of instability would create further pretexts and further new X factors introduced into a deteriorating status quo, which could be weaponized and springboarded and parlayed and flipped into a greater conflict of a global scale. because faiths typically react to crises. And war is a reaction to crises of last resort. So it would be absurd not to have that possible. Now, how the United States plans to buy these things is another question. And whatever assets, Russian assets were seized, Russia would begin from that being the bank from which that is paid. So they can actually get that which was seized back. So there's many, many reasons. It's not a morality play. It's about winning and being on the surviving end. Raphael asked, what do you think about the theory that there's at least one, if not more, Western intelligence units in Mariupol with Azov, especially since there's been at least four helicopters, three of which were shot down, sent in to get someone out of there? Well, yes, of course, there are Western intelligence units embedded with these Nazis. They were primarily involved in the training of these groups. And I haven't examined the evidence of this, about this particular case, but we should equate Azov to ISIS. And we knew that in Syria, that wherever there was like an ISIS, you always had American and CIA advisors. You had Pentagon advisors and CIA advisors, and they have the same knowledge base, but they're actually working on conflicting sides. You had more like Pentagon military advisors embedded with the Kurds and the post-Kurdish kind of reformation of the Syrian Defense Forces, SDF, and others with the FSA. A lot of the SDF was pulled out of a merger between Kurds and FSA, separate from the Turkish FSA, the TFSA. But with regard to the ISIS formations that were, you know, and they were different too, because you had Qatari, Saudi, and etc. But among some of them on that end, this was already the beginning of a conflict between an inter-elite conflict in the deep state. You really actually had differing agendas between the Pentagon and the CIA. And the attempt at that time in the Syrian war was to figure out how to make that chaos work for the destruction of Syria, since that was the goal. So you can have a society already suffering a great cleavage and great divisions, like the U.S. deep state, and put in differing factions of that those factions into Syria. And the Pentagon SDF tried to mirror as much as possible more like the normal practices of humanitarian approach to civilians and so forth, and taking prisoners of war that the regular Syrian Arab army had done. But the ISIS groups were from the CIA, actually based upon the type of training that the Nazis and had built in with the CIA, and had built, for example, with death squads and the throat slitters, like at the School of the Americas, where fascist dictatorships and movements popped up, financed by the deep state in Latin America. So it would be surprising if in Mariupol, which is obviously an Azov stronghold because the Sea of Azov is their namesake and it's right there, Mariupol on the Sea of Azov, as a port town. It would be surprising if the CIA combat units were not there as advisors in, you know, the hundreds, but definitely dozens. I just haven't seen evidence of it, but because that's the practice, I would look for, you know, evidence that tends to suggest it. I would be harder to be dissuaded from that, is what I would say, since the overall assumption is that they should be there. Let's see. I'm looking for questions. And I didn't clearly delineate questions or conversation, so that's on me. I actually had a theme to talk on, and then I took questions later, so that's on me. But because I didn't organize it correctly, it's and my apologies, I can't see where the questions are. So yes, with that, I think we're good to complete, to wrap up. And I want to thank you. This will be available to my supporters. And if you're interested in subscribing, wait until tomorrow, April 1st, to ask me. To don't minimize value, because it bills on the subscription, and then again on the first or the third. So just wait until the top of the month if you're interested. And I want to thank you all for your time, and for your ears and your questions. And God bless, and have a great day.